Welcome to In My Backyard, an open conversation about children and mental health. We all know a child who's struggling, whether that child tells us or not. In this podcast, we speak with experts on the many factors of emotional distress in children, how to address those factors, and how to create a community where all children can be healthy and happy. This podcast is made possible through generous donations from supporters and listeners like you. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation or join our Hope and Healing Club to become a monthly donor today. Your host is Tricia Costales, CEO of the Guidance Center, a nonprofit children's mental health agency in Long Beach, California.
I'm Tricia Costales, your host of In My Backyard. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and the chief executive officer of the Guidance Center, a nonprofit children's mental health agency serving 3,500 children and families every year. We spoke in the last episode about the over-reliance on police to intervene in psychiatric crises, which is outside of law enforcement expertise and perhaps an inappropriate allocation of public safety resources. Today, we're going to discuss one of the downstream consequences of having a law enforcement response to behavioral health, namely the criminalization and incarceration of our mentally ill. According to a report by Eric Westervelt of NPR, the three largest mental health providers in the United States are Twin Towers Jail in LA County, Cook County Jail in Chicago, and Rikers Island in New York. According to the Treatment Advocacy Center's Elizabeth Hank, it's a humanitarian crisis that local jails and prisons have become the de facto mental health institutions for our most fragile individuals. In Twin Towers, mentally ill inmates are kept shackled when outside their cells, while LA Sheriff's Captain Tanya Plunkett of Twin Towers Access to Care Bureau admits that because of spacing and the lack of programming, they're not able to really focus on getting the inmate better. In fact, incarceration tends to worsen the mental health of our already vulnerable mentally ill inmates, who are often held in jail pre-trial, waiting for a treatment bed for a longer time than their sentence would have been. During this time, they lose access to care providers, loved ones, subsidized housing, and medical benefits. The outcome is very often a heightened recidivism, meaning we are quite likely to see them back in jail. Speaking specifically to children, the statistics are equally alarming. According to researchers Lee Underwood and Arissa Washington, there are approximately 2 million juveniles incarcerated in the United States, and up to 80% of these children have at least one diagnosable mental illness. In Los Angeles County, Dr. John Sharon of the Department of Mental Health reports that more than 90% of the youth incarcerated in this county meet the criteria for a mental health disorder. Unlike incarcerated adults with very limited treatment options, children sent to residential programs by juvenile courts might have access to mental health care. The problem is that not all programs are created equal and can vary widely state by state. While California has short-term residential treatment programs for probation youth, that same child in another state might not have the same access to care. There are a multitude of evidence-based practices that are effective in treating even our more severe mental illnesses and behavioral disorders. These statistics then all beg the question, why are we incarcerating the mentally ill if we are not universally providing them with treatment? In today's podcast, we're going to speak with Melissa Mojica, a licensed marriage and family therapist with the Guidance Center. Melissa holds a unique role in our agency, serving as the public safety clinician housed in the Long Beach City Jail. There, she assesses and treats the mentally ill men and women who are routinely incarcerated. The Public Safety Clinician Program started 3 years ago as a pilot partnership between the Guidance Center and the Long Beach Police Department. Melissa has served in the role since the inception of the program. Welcome, Melissa. Thank you for joining us today. I know you well, having worked to develop and sustain this important program together. For our audience, will you please share a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My name is Melissa, and I am a licensed marriage and family therapist. And I've been with the Guidance Center since 2018.
Melissa, I have a question for you that I'm sure is shared by some of our listeners. I've been in the Long Beach City Jail, and it's a pretty brutal place. Why on earth would you want this job?
I have worked with children and families since 2010, and I was excited to join the Guidance Center, and I have several friends that are clinicians there, and I've just heard wonderful things about the work that they do. And so when I had applied, I was more focused on working with children and families still. However, this opportunity came to me. So I thought, you know, I would like to apply and see what it's about. I feel that I had already at a point gained enough experience working with children. And so I thought, you know, to really further my professional development to work with adults. And it just so happened these adults happened to be incarcerated. So I was open and excited to learn about this, how to work and support this population alongside with the police department.
Well, I'm going to nudge you just a little bit on that. You know, I had several of my staff who were initially interested in this new program, this new role as we were developing it. But then when we toured the jail, they backed out. So there's something about sort of your fortitude somehow that despite the odd colors and the clanking of the bars and the funny smell in the jail, you have been there for 3 years. So what about this job is clearly rewarding for you? It has been 3 years that you have gone 5 days a week into the jail.
Yes. Wow. I did not know that about the clinicians after the tour. And I don't blame them. I grew up with a lot of family members that are officers. And so I've always had an interest in criminal justice and just seeing how law enforcement is. And initially when I was younger, I did administration of justice major for about a year. And a professor who was an awesome professor, was a retired police officer, told me that in order for me to work in investigations, which was initially what I was interested in, he said I needed to become a police officer. And I love law enforcement, and I really, like, I've grown up around it, so I feel like it's safe for me. I do not see myself as a police officer, and so that actually changed the direction of my major. I went to psychology instead. And so it just so happened that it came like a 180 back to 180, I'm sorry, 360, to coming back to law enforcement and working with this population. So I feel like it was kind of meant to be, I guess.
But
I understand that the jail could be, it is very uninviting, but that's why we have essential oils. And, you know, now the masks help.
That's what I also just for the record want to say, you have done a great job developing empathy and compassion for a client caseload that most would consider somewhat undesirable. So just for the record. But speaking of these clients, I'd like for you, please, to talk to us a little bit about the kind of clients or people that you treat in jail. Like, what are their diagnoses? What are their life circumstances when you see them? Help us understand sort of your typical client.
Okay. Sure. I certainly cannot ignore that the majority of folks that are incarcerated are BIPOC, which is Black, Indigenous, people of color. This is a marginalized population, and I do notice that there are quite a few different zones within Long Beach that are more heavily policed than others. And so the folks that I meet, my priority clientele is individuals who are identified as HFU, which is high frequency utilizers. And that criteria, for somebody to meet that criteria, is basically having two or more arrests in the past 18 months. And so when we focus on recidivism, which is the frequency with which somebody gets arrested, the goal is to meet them at the jail intercept to provide intervention, support services, and resources from there. And so the purpose of my work was to see if we had an intervention in the jail intercept, would that result in decreased recidivism? Will that help somebody from, you know, recidivating again? And so that being my priority clientele, many folks that I meet, I would say the majority, I can't say the majority, sorry, I take that back, but I would say that many of them have a mental illness, a diagnosis. Many of them are not currently in treatment, and many folks are people experiencing homelessness, which we identify as PEH, and the majority are nonviolent crimes. So the folks that where crimes associated with being, you know, homeless, living out in the streets, that could be prevented if we were to follow a housing first model.
Is there a specific sort of case example or person you could sort of describe to us to give us a sense of your clientele?
Sure. There's so many. I would say there was one individual that was I believe he was in his late 20s. He was incarcerated due to frequently contacting the police department. He wanted to be arrested. And when he was finally brought in and I was able to, you know, meet with him and, you know, offer this support, and he did identify a family member as an emergency contact. And so in order for me and the officers, the detention officers in the jail, to know how to appropriately, you know, support this individual, we contacted the family member, and it was disclosed that this person had a TBI, a traumatic brain injury, and was in the service. And so this individual came back with an honorable discharge in 2018, and since then has been just, you know, devolving in his health. And he would refuse to take medication. And one thing that I often see is that individuals who are identified as having severe and persistent mental illness, or what we call SPMI, is that many of them don't understand the gravity of their diagnosis. And so they don't see the need to take medication on a consistent basis. And so that just so happened to be with this individual. And so working with the family, he was then, when they ran him, they noticed that he was on parole. And so the parole officer put a violation on him. When somebody is there for a parole violation, it's an immediate 10-day flash. So they're taken to county for 10 days before whatever other proceedings with court follow. And so by contacting the parole agent and explaining the situation that this person was visibly, you know, having some sort of episode, and from what we heard from the family that he was not taking medication, the parole agent allowed for the drop. He dropped the parole hold, the violation, and we were able to proceed with a hospitalization, a psychiatric hospitalization. And so this individual was, I would like to say, successfully diverted from jail and sent to rehabilitation, which was meeting his needs in that moment. And it just so happened that I maintained communication with the family and with the parole officer. And as of last week, I was informed that he is currently taking an injection shot, which is a once a month shot, and he's doing much better.
That's actually a really great story. Thank you. Yeah. I would argue that is the perfect example of the value of your role diverting a mentally ill individual from incarceration to treatment, mm-hmm. where they can actually get better. So that is actually a very inspiring story. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Now, Melissa, your clients, they are in jail. And I know everyone has a different story, and you alluded to this to some degree, but what are the typical kinds of crimes for which they've been arrested?
I would say the majority are nonviolent crimes. So it could be an individual who is public intoxication, having a controlled substance, vandalism of maybe $400 or less, trespassing, or a violation of a restraining order. Those are the main ones.
Do you see these crimes as related to their mental illness?
I see it as possibly related to their mental illness, substance abuse, and experiencing homelessness.
Okay, so it's all sort of linked together.
I see that,
because
yeah.
we certainly know the link between mental illness and substance abuse and both of those things and homelessness. Mm-hmm. So do you believe that if they had been given effective treatment and community supports prior, that their incarceration might have been able to be prevented?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I believe that right now with the whole political climate and talking about justice reform and allocating with Measure J funds and ATI, which is Alternatives to Incarceration, which is an LA County Health Department initiative, that once we start putting more money into the community-based organizations, that we can hopefully see a change and reduction in arrests and increase in utilization of services that are offered to them. Right now, I mean, I meet somebody who may be released at, let's say, 7 p.m., and it is a struggle to find an agency that is not at capacity and that can take them at that time. Usually, let's say if we're looking for a shelter or for a hospital bed, you have to call very early in the morning and just wait. It really is a waiting game. And so it would be wonderful to know that there are more organizations that are available that can take these folks and help them, and not just in a short-term program, but help with long-term support services. I know that a lot of folks that we get successfully into drug programs or shelters, they'll be there. Maybe the drug program would be for 30 or 60 days, and then they're put in transitional housing. But one thing that I notice is that a lot of folks that accept the diversion that's offered to them, it's not long enough. And so I would really like to see, as a result of ATI initiative, to see longer term programs being offered.
And just ATI is Alternatives to Incarceration, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, I remember when I supervised you directly, we would speak sometimes and you would tell me about inmates who were actively, floridly in the middle of a psychotic break, and you were able to still to de-escalate them, to engage with them. They weren't at the point where they required involuntary hospitalization, but they were still in jail. Is that the right place for them? I know that they may not meet eligibility criteria for a psych hospital, but is that the right place for someone who's floridly psychotic?
Oh, Tricia, you hit a hot button for me. this has been by far the most challenging type of client that I visit with, and also just the most frustrating and emotionally draining for me. When I meet individuals there that are exhibiting positive symptoms of, let's say, a psychotic episode, I try in all my efforts to de-escalate and to offer support services. And to answer your question, no, I do not agree that this is the right place for them. One thing I have learned while working with law enforcement is that the crime supersedes the illness. So if an individual is there and they commit a crime that is a felony crime, and, you know, given historical context, which is what police departments search when they look at and they're running a rap sheet on an individual, then that will determine if this person can be released on an OR, which is their own recognizance, and I can follow through with the 5150, which is an involuntary hospitalization. Many times, this is not the case. If they are there for a misdemeanor charge, then I'm on it. And I definitely work with the police department, and they too are in agreement that this person or this individual does not belong here, that they need appropriate rehabilitative support services. For the folks that are there on felony charge, it's just a matter of me trying to build rapport with them and trust and increase their cooperation, so that way I can prevent any other a potential use of force or anything that can aggravate either side, the individual who is visibly ill, and also for the safety of the officers that are working in the jail.
So in that sense, it becomes almost a a containment of sorts.
Yeah, right.
In the absence of being able to provide sort of services outside, it becomes a containment and a let's keep everybody safe under these circumstances.
Right, absolutely. And another thing that I do when it is these special types of cases is I will try my best to contact family. just to get a better understanding of what's been going on. The officers as well really appreciate this information because they too don't know. So if this person is from out of state, for example, the family may not even know that they're here. And that has happened on several occasions where the family, where this individual is incarcerated and the family has informed us that they put out a missing persons report. So I just can't imagine for the family to be, you know, so overwhelmed and just not know where their loved one is and to find out that they are across the country, you know, and living out on the streets. It's just heartbreaking. So I do my best to try and support the family members and provide them the appropriate resources where they can, you know, again, I can support reunification. There is a program here in the police department, which is called Homeward Bound, where if an individual is connected to a resource and family confirms, like, yes, we will, you know, be here to support this, our loved one, our relative, they will help, you know, they will financially support the person to return home financially. So they can get them like a ticket for a Greyhound or however to get them back home.
Now, Melissa, as licensed clinicians, you and I understand what it means to interact with someone who is in the middle of a psychotic break, but a number of our listeners may not. So let's sort through for them, please. What does it look like? How do you know someone you're interacting with is in the middle of active psychosis?
Sure. Initially, I'll start with just a mini status exam, a mental status exam. So asking them, you know, questions of where they know, if they know where they are, what's today, what city are we in, what's their name, when's their date of birth. That kind of gives me a little glimpse of where they are. Many times I will meet individuals who are paranoid. They believe that they're being watched, they're being stalked, that there are devices in police officers or myself that are recording them. It really consists of a psychosis, but that I describe it as would be as an individual who is having active delusions or hallucinations, avolition. They have this, the difficulty in putting words together to express what they're thinking and feeling. Let's see what else. I would see maybe like a word salad, which again would be like the avolition, just having difficulty putting together sentences and explaining what is happening. The paranoia is a big one that I see. Trying to think of anything else, anything that you can think of.
Well, and I think one thing that's important for listeners to understand is it is detachment from reality, but
yes.
for that patient, for that client at that time, that is reality. Their hallucination, their delusion, it's real for them. So there's no saying, no, of course, I have not implanted a CIA device in you, through your food. But because for that inmate, that person at that time, that is real. Mm-hmm. So a psychotic break is truly a detachment from reality, and you can see some very disorganized behavior and decision making as a result of that.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
So, Melissa, I understand, and correct me if this is somewhat wrong, but I believe that your clients, the inmates, tend to be in the Long Beach City Jail for about 3 days before they're released pretrial or sent to LA County Jail. Is that generally correct that they're there for about 3 days?
So the Long Beach City Jail is classified as a Type 1 facility. So that means that under Title 15, an individual cannot be held for more than 96 hours. So basically, when an individual is brought in, it's 2 working days until they go to court. So they are awaiting the charges that are going to be filed. They are not yet sentenced individuals. So if somebody comes in on Monday, they'll likely go to court on Wednesday. However, if you are coming in on Thursday, you'll be going to court on Monday. and Friday to Tuesday. So it really depends. But the longest that somebody would be there would be over the weekend or if there's a holiday, something like that.
Well, and the reason I'm asking, because that isn't very long to help a person. Right. You're kind of in and out with your interventions and your assessments. What happens to them after they leave?
Ooh. So the big part of my job is to identify the priority needs of this individual. So if they want to speak with me, you know, I'm here to offer support and really help them identify, you know, what is going on and how can we stop this cycle if they are identified as a high frequency utilizer or whatever they're being, you know, charged with at that time. So what we do is we complete a brief assessment that was followed after GUIDES. GUIDES is an assessment, which is a quadruplicate assessment that is provided in other county jails and prisons across the nation. And so what we were able to do with the Guidance Center was to create our own specific version, very relevant to the Long Beach Police Department and Long Beach. And so by completing this assessment and identifying the priority needs, that this individual is thus agreeing to a post-release plan. And so that may be where either I leave them with resources or if they accept a referral and authorize me to send a referral on their behalf, then I will contact the linkage or the agency to notify them that I have somebody who's interested in support services. If this individual goes to county, which is a majority of the folks that I meet, then we do have in-county referral process. So that is offered through the Department of Health for LA County, where they have many organizations, one being Whole Person Care. And these are individuals that are identified as community health workers or individuals with lived experience. And they take on the referral and they are met with somebody who's at county jail, signs them up for the services, and then they meet them. They sign them up for services while they're in county. And then when they're released, they begin those support services.
So when they're released from county jail, in theory, they're connecting with services upon their release.
Correct. So yeah, I'm sorry. Okay. Let me like rephrase that. So it's basically I meet with them. We identify priority needs. If they're being released from Long Beach, then they go directly to those services that I referred them to or provided the resources. If they're going to county, then I notify my county contact, which is Whole Person Care, and they meet them there. So I will tell this person, hey, be aware you're going to meet with somebody who's going to say identify as a community health worker or Whole Person Care, and they're going to explain further the resources that they have available to you with this agency or with the organization, and then they move from there.
Okay, so what we've accomplished then is identification and linkage to services. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now we have heard, I talked a little bit in the introduction about Twin Towers, which is the LA County jail. Mm-hmm. So when you're saying county, I imagine it's probably Twin Towers. Mm-hmm. And it's not an ideal place for people with a mental illness or having a mental health crisis. So, you know, how sort of fluid is this process of referral and post-incarceration linkage once they're in the county system?
Ooh, that's a great question. And that's one that I wish I knew more of in regards to what happens after I set out the referral. The best that we can do right now is that re-request, you know, with Whole Person Care, if they can give us the number of folks that they actually were met when they transferred over to county. Twin Towers, like you had mentioned, is known as a huge psychiatric facility. And that building, I believe, is like 6 floors. And they are always at capacity. So that certainly is, you know, a big issue that we cannot ignore. Men's Central Jail as well is always at capacity as well. I don't know how big their psychiatric services are or if they take them over to Twin Towers when an individual is needing mental health care. So I believe that, you know, the best the best way for me to really get an update would be to have direct contact with that individual when they are released. And many times, you know, they'll give me a phone number or, you know, an email or the number of a loved one to try and stay in contact. But it is pretty difficult right now, and especially with the pandemic. You know, I felt like we were getting on a good roll prior to March of last year. And then the pandemic hit and, you know, everything has halted. So sure. Right now it's just we're basically trying to rebuild right now.
I would like to move the conversation now to the incarceration of juveniles with a mental health disorder. While I agree that the criminalization of the mentally ill in general is a humanitarian crisis, I'm particularly saddened by what we are doing to our vulnerable youth. Again, according to researchers Underwood and Washington, the typical diagnoses of incarcerated youth tend to be serious mood disorders such as depression, some bipolar and psychotic disorders, anxiety disorders, including post-traumatic stress disorder, and the behavioral disorders that are so often a hallmark of childhood trauma. Mental health providers understand the links between mental health issues and behavior. The irritability that comes with depression can be seen in heightened displays of anger and engaging in fights. A child with PTSD and other trauma-related disorders might find it difficult to regulate emotion. This might lead them to perceive interactions with others as threatening and act accordingly. There's a legitimate need for public safety, but as community-based mental health resources have been inadequate to meet the demand, juvenile justice systems have been utilized as an alternative. We are, in effect, incarcerating young people for displaying behaviors that are consistent with their mental health disorder. And it hasn't worked. Noted in the review by Underwood and Washington, when we incarcerate youth, we create adult offenders. Although incarceration is necessary for a small percent of juveniles, long-term confinement experiences tend to do more harm than good, often leading to continued offending and recidivism. By comparison, community-based mental health treatment has been demonstrated to be effective at decreasing criminal behavior, even for youth who commit serious and violent crimes. So I understand that in the Long Beach City Jail, you primarily see adults with occasionally some teens as young as 13 even, but all adults were also once children. How do the statistics about youth mental health and criminality resonate with you and your client population?
So, wow. One experience that I've had since working in the jail is when I meet with individuals and I am sending over the information to our agency to open up the case, and I realize that this individual was once a client of the guidance center. And so my curiosity just being, okay, having with my experience working with children and families, it's to prevent, you know, the cracks, children falling through those cracks and falling into the system. And so one awesome thing that PGC has allowed me to do was to look through past notes or assessments to see what happened. Where did this fall off? And what I have seen is that many of these kids, they either went to a juvenile detention center. And so, of course, with providing services, we have to stop on our end. So that way providers in the facilities and the residential facilities can begin with services. Some of them, they just stopped coming. It was just they no longer wanted participation, or it was difficult to contact the family. and I do ask, you know, these individuals, you know, what was your experience like? And I've never heard anybody say that they did not appreciate therapy that as children. So I noticed it's like, well, how do we continue to support a child in spite of them going from one place to another, let's say group homes or, you know, these juvenile centers? How can we continue with the support service if they're building rapport and they're already, you know, maybe at a level of distrust given extensive trauma that they've been experiencing, that they naturally do not want to open up and trust individuals? And so what is it like for a kid to build a relationship with a therapist over a year, they do something and then they're, you know, sent over to a different facility and now they have to start rebuilding with somebody else. How are we really supporting that trust that for that individual and their development? That's one big question that I have, that I see.
That's really interesting. I didn't really realize that you saw that dynamic in your adult clients, but that makes quite a lot of sense. One of the frustrations of being a child mental health provider is when the children do disappear or are moved away, they switch foster homes and they're no longer in your area, or they're put to into a group home, or they are sent to juvenile camps or juvenile authorities. Even though we know that we're working with them on the behavioral issues that led to the criminal behavior, but then all of a sudden there's a rupture in the therapeutic relationship and we don't get to continue treating them. But I hadn't realized that you'd seen that actually the adult outcome of those ruptures in services. So you do see clients with a childhood history of legal troubles or of childhood trauma that is an underpinning of the adults that you see?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't deny that the majority of folks that I meet probably have a high ACE score, you know, which is ACE's score is adverse childhood experiences. So
for our listeners, the ACEs is a well-established, it's just a score. It's a standardized test that you can administer to anybody, and it counts the number of adverse childhood events that someone experiences growing up. And the higher your number, the greater exposure level to traumas a child has experienced. So what Melissa is saying here, Melissa, not to put words in your mouth, so correct me, is that her clients in the city jail have high ACEs scores, meaning high levels of early childhood traumas.
Yeah, that's right.
And so seeing this, I mean, I think you do an amazing job, but I think it's pretty evident in what you're sharing with us today. There are a number of frustrations that go along with this in terms of trying to get these people connected to the correct systems or the correct service opportunities. We know that treatment works, so it's a matter of finding ways to connect them to that in a long-standing way. So with what you know better than anybody, with what you know about the current system, what do you wish we could do differently to help your client population?
One big aspect that I feel would be a positive turn, you know, would be, I guess, with the work that ATI is starting, which is the Alternatives to Incarceration, is to identify which calls are appropriate for police and which ones are more appropriate for mental health professionals. I understand that they are developing a mental health crisis call, which is going to be 988. But just to give you another example of another big, you know, gap that I see, a service gap, is that I have my year-end report for 2020. And here, according to 2020, I met with 231 individuals. 62% of those individuals were identified as a high-frequency utilizer. 35% of those offenses are classified as felonies. 55% of those high-frequency utilizers or individuals are experiencing homelessness. And so what I was curious about was to see, for these folks that are being released, and for us to get a better understanding of the linkage, the successful linkages to services within the community, what time are they leaving? So we started to collect that data of when are folks leaving. And what we found was that between 1 and 7:30 in the morning, 5% of releases are happening. 0% of releases is between 7:30 and 1500, which is 2 o'clock. 50% is between 1500 and 1900, and 45% of these releases are between 1900 and 24. So that just illustrates that individuals that are being released to the community are being released during non-working hours. And so that further illustrates that community-based organizations need to extend their hours, their working hours, to have availability for these folks that are being released into the community from jail, and they have somewhere to go rather than me scrambling around or, you know, another provider scrambling around trying to find a spot before 2 p.m. It's a big frustration, and I believe that that's a huge service gap, that and transportation, which I advocate for with all of my work. You know, if there's somebody new that wants to come in, it's like, do you have transportation? Because, you know, I can get them a bed, I can get them there. And then they say, okay, yeah, just have them come over. It's like, okay, how do I get them there? You know, that's a big problem as well.
I don't imagine it's a client population you can say, here's a bus token, go make your way there. I don't imagine that route tends to be very successful. So you could argue that certainly community-based organizations need to have hours that are accessible to clients and potential clients and the population they serve. On the flip side, it does beg the question, why are jails releasing people at 10 o'clock at night? There could be some sort of coordination between the jail systems and the community-based organizations so they can come together and better accommodate the lives of these people, so we're not just releasing mm-hmm. them in the dark back out onto the streets. Because otherwise, what have we accomplished by jailing mm-hmm. them in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. I agree. And this was brought up given the data that we've been collecting to illustrate this. I feel that, you know, I'm very grateful that this opportunity was provided to me with the Long Beach Police Department, because they are more on the innovative side. So they are more willing to listen and we work together. And so let's say if I were to try something like this in county jail, I mean, you know, that's thousands of individuals, you know? And so I really do acknowledge that the Long Beach Police Department is all ears, that they are willing to try different things with us. To see what works and what doesn't.
I mean, absolutely. I think it's 100% to their credit, even that they want you in their system. They want you in their jail. So what about sort of our current generation of young people? What do you think we could do differently to help prevent them from being your client in the future? Mm.
That is a loaded question, Trisha. Well, I would say certainly we can't avoid the school to prison pipeline, right? To really identify and to provide supportive services in place rather than punishment for these children that are in school and are having difficulties. And as we know, a lot of these children exhibit these types of behaviors in school, and that's actually going on at home, that they maybe feel restricted or unable to express how they feel of whatever trauma or things that are going on at home that are difficult for them. And so I do not believe that the solution is to punish them, you know, and we can't ignore that there is the school to prison pipeline. And so if we begin to address and implement a better solution to helping these kids while they're in school, then maybe it could result in, you know, decreased incarceration.
I mean, that would be my goal. I think people who know me know that adopting a trauma-informed approach and understanding children's behavior is my soapbox. It's the sword I'm willing to die upon. So I think that's absolutely right. We need to approach behavior as an indicator of a struggle and do remediative efforts and therapeutic efforts rather than going first to punishment. It was interesting. We spoke in our prior episode with the retired LAPD detective from their SMART team, their MET team, their mental evaluation team. And his take was, when, you know, a hammer sees everything as a nail, and when you have law enforcement be the first response to mental health issues or behavioral or emotional struggles, they're going to see it like a nail. And mm-hmm. we're detaining rather than treating is my mm-hmm. my philosophical belief. I don't know if that resonates with you at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. It does. I understand that the police officers here are there to do their job, but we cannot trust that they have the appropriate training for all of these situations and calls that they have to answer to, you know, and I believe that, you know, some sort of reform will hopefully help these folks and assist them in a way.
Right.
And maybe, yeah.
Exactly. And I believe it would assist our criminal justice system as well, because then they could use their limited resources for the issues of public safety, not mental health treatment.
Right.
Well, thank you, Melissa, for sharing your insights and your very unique experiences as a mental health provider in a jail system. You've given us insight into a place, an institution, a system that we would never have been able to access otherwise. So thank you.
Well, thank you for this opportunity. I couldn't have been here without you. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Melissa. Bye.
Bye-bye.
What we have highlighted today is the incredible disservice we've done to our most vulnerable individuals with a mental illness, as well as to the criminal justice system. As community-based services have been increasingly under-resourced, the burden to contain and manage the mentally ill has fallen to a criminal justice system that is ill-suited to managing it. Although we may be temporarily getting the more troublesome mentally ill off the street, we are incarcerating them in systems that don't provide the treatment and resources they need for a successful outcome. The cycle repeats. I hope that we've all gained some insight, even if simply a greater understanding of the issue. It's my position that by shining a light on these issues, admitting that they are in our own backyards, it will be easier for someone struggling to get some help. Ideally, we can all begin to be kinder and more supportive of each other. Please join me for episode 6 when we speak with Aubrey Sweeney, Chief Executive Officer of Rancho San Antonio Boys Home. Rancho offers a short-term residential treatment program for court-ordered boys. Rather than warehousing these children, the treatment model at Rancho offers an opportunity for rehabilitation, focusing on the psychological, social, physical, and educational needs of the individual, not just the behavior that got them there.
In My Backyard is brought to you by the Guidance Center, a children's mental health agency in Long Beach, California. In My Backyard is produced by Tricia Costales and Matthew Murray. Production assistance provided by Julie Ruano. Thank you to J. Vincent B. for original music. All other music licensed through Soundstripe. Thank you to our listeners and supporters. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation or join our Hope and Healing Club to become a monthly donor today. Subscribe to In My Backyard on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.